I'm going to read something else to you. It's from a book. I don't, does that look, does that, is that long enough to have you realize what I'm holding? Maybe not.
You're holding a brain or something.
Well, it's the original, it's an original, and I'm going to
Yes.
read the inscription to you. It
Okay.
was signed in New York in December 13th, on December 13th of 1968. And it says, "With warm wishes for a happy Christmas, Mark Crowley." So
Really?
I wanted to
That's
share.
true.
So
That is
that
true.
is, that's the original cover, I guess, of Boys in the Band.
Oh my goodness, yes. Okay.
And you have a little to do with Boys in the Band in your life. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I met Mark Crowley when I went to Catholic University after I'd been in the Army. And I was a graduate student. He was an undergraduate student. And with my anti-authoritarian, anarchic attitude toward a lot of things, I had just come out of the Army. And a lot of that had been resourced, in a sense, because the Army put into me some of the ideas of discipline and working with the group. And I was at that time a second first lieutenant, and I had 7 years of reserve to still do. But I was aware of myself in a different way when I went back to working as an actor to be and a playwright to be. And there was a play, there were two theaters on the campus at Catholic University. One was the main stage, which had been midnight requisitioned by Father Hartke, our mentor, because he could do anything. He could get anything done in Washington. I mean, he was the Joe Biden of his day. He knew the levers to pull and push. Anyway, he was a wonderful man. But anyway, the second theater was the original one, which was in some sort of a brick building. It was a and they called it the Lab Theater, but actually they used it as a place where they took all the old sets and costumes and dumped them. And so, but if you wanted to work in the theater, then you were not going to get a job on the main stage where all the Broadway headed folks seem to dwell. You went to the lab stuff. Well, I was one of the guys that could get on the main stage and had already done it. But I was drawn to this lab place because my amateur spirit, which has never left me, I will work for free if I can express something, particularly with social justice involved. So I went to the lab to do a show. I think it was Morning Becomes Electra, which was Eugene O'Neill's really, really undone play and should remain undone. But it was Mart was doing a lab of this, and I met the kid, Mart Crowley, and he was from Mississippi. I'm from Arkansas. And we had that in common right away because we're the only two Southerners around, the real Southerners that knew what it was and knew we had a secret code. And he used to make beautiful stuff out of all this junk to put his put a makeup on the stage. And it was quite interesting. And I was interested in that. But then, of course, it faded away because we separated. And I got a call. I was in Arkansas visiting my aunt who helped raise me. And I got a call from Mart from Mississippi. He said, "Can I come and visit with you?" I said, "Yes, sure." And I borrowed my aunt's car and I met him at the airport. We dragged the drag. We went to the Dairy Queen, that kind of stuff in a small town. And then we sat beside the railroad tracks and watched the greasy creek flow by with the snakes in it, and as Tennessee Williams seen. And we were talking about our families. And I said, "You know, Marta, I'm having trouble with my family because I can't seem to feel anything. I don't know how to love." And he looked at me with shock. And he said, my family is far worse than yours, Larry. My mother is a drug addict. My father is an alcoholic. They honor each other all the time. And that's why I'm here. I couldn't stand it anymore. I had to get out of there. And then he moved closer to me, and he was just looking at me through his big glasses and didn't say anything more. And I looked into his eyes, and I realized that he was asking for something. And then I realized I couldn't respond in the way that he wanted me to. So we separated on that basis. And 11 years later, I'm working two jobs in New York. One was paying me dough, which was a television job, a secret storm. And the other, I was volunteering to teach at community college and all that kind of stuff. And I get a script that I'm told to read, and I read the script, and it's by Mart, and it's called The Boys in the Band, and it's nine gay men celebrating a birthday, which turns into an absolute bloodbath. Oh, I don't want anybody to say that word, bloodbath.
Well, they have a lot of fights and disagreements. You and one other, there was one other straight man in the cast. Everybody else was gay, and I know several of them passed away of AIDS.
They've all passed away.
Lawrence Fry, for example, who people would know from Fiddler on the Roof. But the bottom line is, did performing in that play, playing a gay man named Hank, and
yes,
in the movie, did it change your life? Did it open your life, or did it just feed views that you had anyway in terms of acceptance and tolerance?
I have been abused when I was 16. It's in the book. And that bothered me so much throughout my life, to wonder if I was gay, because that's what it does to you when you are you have no personality of your own, and suddenly you meet somebody who's really knows about the world, is older, blah, 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 blah. And then things become expected sexually and all of that. But at that juncture, when I saw the play, and I knew it was a good play, it was a really good play, and I decided, this is not a problem. I'm doing this play. Why? Because of Mart. Mart is my friend.
Yeah.
Period. I told
him at that time it was a risky thing potentially to do on Broadway.
Well, my agent, who also represented the play, said, when I told her that I was going to play it, do a part, she said, all right, but of course you may have just smashed your career to hell, but okay. And, you know, and fine. But when I know we're short on time, I'll just say it was the greatest thing I did for myself in my life. It put me on the map. It was after 11 years of schlepping and struggling in New York City, it came to be a crown, and it was 3 years of our lives, which when you're that young is a lot of work for a lot of what. And it became a play with a part in which gay men, even today, someone here in Palm Springs is going to come up to me and say, I saw you in that movie and it changed my life, because I realized I could be like you. I was the one guy in the whole scheme of things in the play who told the truth and was unafraid. I was not trapped by the closet, and all the rest of the guys were. And I realized that the guys that stood up in that play were the heroes, because they outed themselves in 1967, which was extremely dangerous.
And I was honored to go to the revival on Broadway with Andrew Rannells and James Parson and all those folks. And I know you were resistant to go to that at first.
I was at first, but then David Zippel, who is a lyricist and a wonderful man, was standing here in this kitchen right here. And he said, are you going to that? And I said, no, I don't want to go to that. All the brouhaha, I'm tired of that stuff. He said, you have to go. And I said, why? And he said, because of the guys. And I realized that that was true. And I got 3 seconds on the red carpet, my last 3 seconds of fame. And
no, I doubt that. So, Larry, you agree to do Boys in the Band, risky for your career, as you noted. Your agent may say this is it, but you were still committed to doing it. This was not 2024 that you're making that decision. Today, who cares? Back then, it was a risk you didn't mind taking.
No, I didn't. I didn't because he was a friend. It was that simple. And I learned things about myself. I mean, I do, you know, I honor friendship. But the risk was there. And when I first felt it was the first, after they yelled cut on the very first scene of the movie. And I thought, now I'm really in the soup because this is on film. And but of course, that was a fleeting feeling. Because the work was there to do. And so I did the work.
But by the way, question about the movie, and you write about this, but like for the revival on Broadway, the entire cast was gay. In the play version you were in, almost all gay except for you and one other actor. But when the movie came around, all of a sudden, enter the world of producers. Yeah, we'll do this, but don't give me those. And I'm not going to say what they said, but we don't want the gay guys in this.
That's right. That was Ray Stark, and he offered Mart $250,000 for the rights, which in 1967 was to make him a rich man. And he said the only stipulation is we have to use Hollywood actors instead of the
Broadway cast.
The gay men in the cast then. And so we started immediately backstage laughing about, well, let's see, should it be Roddy McDowell playing this? Should it be
Dick Sargent?
Yes, and all the other people that were gay but closed off in Hollywood,
right?
Locked into the closet as far as they could get. But you know, the one thing that was actually missing from the revival, and Joe Mantello is a friend. Who directed? And he directed.
I just saw him last week. He's in Chicago directing now. He's directing over at Steppenwolf. So I've seen him a couple times.
Oh, he's Steppenwolf. That's great.
Yeah.
How's his foot? He broke his foot.
He was on crutches.
He's still on crutches. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, I said to him, I sent the script to him and right away, just so he would take a look because we got to be friends in that. Surround of the revival, and I said, Joe, the one thing missing which you could not supply was the closet. These guys are out. These guys are successful. They don't know about the closet. And when I mentioned that to one of them, it might have been Andrew. He said, No, the closet's still here because certain people still have to be in it. And I suppose that's the more flamboyant folks. But the closet did such terrible things to people. It put them back into a place where they had to live as pariahs, a group of pariahs like lepers. It was terrible. And it was dangerous. In Arkansas, of course, you could easily be killed if people knew you were gay.
So and by the way, I mentioned Dick Sargent, who for viewers may not know, he was the second Darren in Bewitched, and he and I were friends. And one of the things he said to me was he had a resume that actually had like fake weddings, fake marriages on it and stuff. And he said, Paul, that's what you had to do in Hollywood in those days. You had to make it up. So I'm sort of curious, you know, here you were a straight guy doing it, but did you pay a price? People warned you might, but did you? I don't think you did.
Well, I lost a true commercial, a cigarette commercial. I was the big face on the camera, taking a big suck of a cigarette and letting the smoke go into your face.
Ah, the good old days.
Oh man, this tastes good or something like that. And the director of those, the casting director, called me up and said, "It's time to renew because this thing had played 39 weeks. I was making a ton of money from it, and I had done almost nothing, and I don't smoke cigarettes anyway. Nobody cared. Just get the smoke out there and then go wash your mouth out, you know. It's kind of like, anyway, he said they got to see you again to renew the contract. And I said, fine. So I went up there, I read some copies similar to the other copy, almost a carbon copy of the thing. And these guys, all the suits, all lit up before I read the script. And I thought, that's really funny. Do they have to smoke? Are they required to smoke cigarettes? Because the room was filled with smoke, you know. Anyway, I was on my way downstairs to Grand Central, which was across the street from the building. And the casting director's girl came and said, come back, please, right now. I did. And the suits were gone, but the casting director said to me, and by the way, he was gay, and he had wonderful hair that was much too gold to be gold, but he also was a very, very kind, smart, humorous guy. And he said, I'm sorry to tell you this, but they don't want to renew the contract. And I said, was it something I said? And they said, he said, no, the only word we had, and can I say this on your air?
If not, Julian will take it out. Go ahead.
All right. Okay. He said, no fags smoke our fags.
Ah.
And I was canceled. So I laughed about it because, you know, again, money was not my issue. I liked it when it came in, but it was not my issue. I didn't run to it like you're supposed to. But I saw the sadness in this casting director's face, and he wasn't laughing about this. If to him, it was part of his business going to hell, but also simply a rejection of him somehow.
Yeah, just such a tough. Things are different today. Things are better today, but there's still difficulties and restrictions. You know, Larry, as we're talking, and I want to shift to a different area, you'll notice what I have not done, and I'm sure you're doing a lot of interviews, and probably everybody wants to talk about Star Trek and just all these, you know, the television appearances you've done. And I get it, because I think you can probably, I can't do that, but you can probably still do that thing.
I can do that.
Yeah, there you go. But you'll notice, and it's, I hope with your permission, I'm sort of not talking about the commercial stuff, because as I told you, I was so moved by other messages in the book that my focus is just different. And so I hope you're okay with what I'm with my approach. If you want to talk about Star Trek, we can. But I want to talk about your one-man shows, because the people that you selected, Clarence Darrow, and I didn't bring my signed Clarence Darrow book to show you, but I have.
Oh, you have his biography?
Yes, and I have a signed book by Ernest Hemingway. See, you two have to come to Chicago. My collection's been featured on Collector's Call, and there's kind of a museum here. But Teddy Roosevelt and LBJ, actually, you have to tell, if you don't mind, this great LBJ story, because it involved David Susskind, who's a well-known TV performer but a talk show host, I guess, in Chicago.
Right.
He enters your life, and interesting tie, he was also tied to Lucy.
That's correct. It was 1986. It was cold outside in New York. We had an office in the Equity Building just above the our union, and I was looking out at the smoke coming up, the wonderful steam that rises in all cities in the wintertime, and wondering about Christmas presents for my five kids. I hadn't worked in I don't know how many months, and I was panicked. And so I did a rant. I did a wonderful rant in the office where it was acceptable to the two ladies who were sitting there, which is our wonderful Elizabeth Edwards and my wife. And so they endured my rant. I'm never going to do this again. I'm quitting. I hate acting. I'm stopping. And the phone rang. And it was David Susskind. And David was my Dutch uncle. You know what a Dutch uncle is?
I don't. No, what is a Dutch uncle?
Okay. All right. Dutch uncle refers to the knuckle rub that you get from a close relative who wants you to be something better than you are.
It's a good thing.
Yeah, yes. As somebody that's a mentor in a hurtful, that hurts yourself when you're a kid. Anyway, David was like that for me. He would call me up and offer me stuff, and I would refuse it because I'd just say, David, this is crap. I can't do this. And he'd say, why? You're unemployed, aren't you? That was his gauge for everything. So I said, I picked up this script and I looked at it, 69 pages, single spaced. he had told me that we had to be in Toronto, Canada this week to start with this thing. And it was an insane offer. And I said, I can't do this. This is crazy. And he said, well, why? You're unemployed, aren't you? And he hit my little thing on the head with the nail, nut Dutch rub. And I said, I'm not 6'5". I'm not a terrible, miserable, despicable Southern politician. I've tried to levitate the Capitol in 1968. I hate Lyndon Johnson. And there was a silence. And then David said very calmly, Larry, that will change. So I said, I'm coming up to tell you that I show you that I can't do this. I'm going to read the script to you directly. He said, come on up. I walked up Madison Avenue, went into the building, went into the office, and there's his wonderful, wonderful secretary who said, oh, Larry, we're so glad that you've agreed to do this. It was
willingly
the perfect setup. Yes. Yeah.
And by the way, this is LBJ.
Right. So I sat down knee to knee with him and I began to read. And as I began to read, something came into me. I listened to my own voice and I heard my daddy. Hmm. I heard my father, his Arkansas, Texarkana, Texas, hardscrabble voice. Biblical incantations and all coming through me, and I started to cry. And I sat there and I just looked at David, and David smiled like a fox that he is. He was a fox. And he just looked at me and I said, yes. And that yes changed my life forever. I was able to go into a world of social justice leanings, needings that all these gentlemen represented. Lyndon Johnson, just think about it, the best domestic president we've ever had, short of Joe Biden. And the second one was Clarence Darrow, that people don't remember anymore.
Scopes monkey trial.
Chicagoans certainly
That's
remember
right.
him. Because that's where the hearing was for Leopold and Robe,
right.
Which the Chicago Trib said, when he finished the 12-hour disposition to the judge, it was a hearing, he said his voice was indistinguishable from the silence in the room. And that grabbed me as an actor.
Yeah.
I wrote the play based on all of his stuff. I got the rights to it, which was a fight. And to the material that I needed. And I have done a play about him that is called Clarence Darrow Tonight, which is a really, really good play because it's called What is Justice? And this lawyer, who at the time was almost without a career, was doing lecture shots for $100. And he would go out and talk to these people. And one he arrived at had a sign up in front of it, and it was a long train trip, and he was tired. And it said, Attorney Clarence Darrow will talk tonight on what is justice. So he gets on the stage, and he's like, what? What is justice? Let's see if I can tell you that. And it ends with his saying, does it really matter if there's justice or not? If we can only recognize our common humanity and our common need and work to make people more secure, happier, more safe in proportion to our strength. Now that is, to me, gospel. That is gospel.
And did these men that you played, Darrow and Roosevelt and LBJ, I'll leave one out for a moment. Was this who Larry Luckenbill was, and then these people fit you? Or did you play these people, and including writing about these people, and you became a representation of their values? What came first?
I stood in their shoes, and suddenly I was allowed to be them. I was allowed to take in what they believed about America, what they believed about the world, what they believed about their neighbors, and I was freed like I had never been even dreamed of in a commercial career that I was having as an actor, although I was doing good stuff and always trying to choose things with good positions, social justice-wise. But now I'm dealing with four men who had stood across the 20th century with ideas as Americans that the world had to deal with, the freedom and the inclusion of the world that they wanted.
And by the way, you got the blessing of somebody very important to LBJ, didn't you?
I wait a minute.
I'm talking about Lady Bird.
Oh, yes, Lady Bird. Yes, I became actual friends with Lady Bird. When I first met her, I have to say this, I was talking to Harry Middleton, who was the manager or the executive of the LBJ Library. And we're talking about the show coming up that I was going to do, the Lyndon Show, in that theater. It's an 1,100-seat theater. And this little short woman came around the corner wearing an apron, barefoot, her shoes tucked into her apron. And I thought, oh, cleaning woman. Trust your eyes. Well, a picture is worth nothing. She walked up to me, and I saw who it was, and I couldn't stop myself. I said, "You look just like my mother." And she said, "Why, that is the most wonderful compliment I have ever heard." And I was in love with her right away.
Did she call you Larry Bird?
Huh?
You could have become Larry Bird.
Larry
oh, wait, there
Bird.
Was a Larry Bird. There was a Larry Bird.
There was a Larry Bird, and I can't even bounce a basketball.
Okay. I love it. There is one of the characters you play. By the way, a friend of mine 30 years ago wrote a play, a musical called Thrill Me about Leopold and Loeb. It's never stopped playing.
What's it called?
It's called Thrill Me by Stephen Dolgonoff. I interviewed him. He's a good friend. And if you haven't heard of the play or musical, I will have him send it to you, because I think
Please do.
I will do that.
Because I've seen the stuff that's out there, Compulsion and other things. They're not as, they don't do it. They don't get into it.
I know his plays all over the world, in Korea and everywhere. And he just wrote a book called Thrill Maker, which is the story of how he created that book. I'll have him send you those.
Okay,
so
good.
Eye open for that. But here's the thing. Of the people you've done one-man shows, we have to toss in Ernest Hemingway. I kind of get the connection, but it's a step away from these other men. For one thing, he killed himself. I mean, this is a different person for you, right?
It was a troublesome thing. Because I was 14 when I read everything of Hemingway's. And my friend and I used to talk on the bus going to junior college about the code of manhood and all those things when you're trying to figure yourself out. And and when Hemingway killed himself as a practicing Catholic, I could not accept that. And so I said, well, he's in hell now. The hell with him. And that was my attitude for a long time about Hemingway. And that influenced my feelings about his writing, which is a dangerous damn thing to realize that some kind of religious compulsion could create a difference in what you read. That's intolerable too. So anarchist that I am, I was going against that. So now I said to myself, it's a long story. How I got to the point of accepting the task of taking on Ernest. But we could talk about that a little bit. I know you haven't got much time right now.
But we're okay. Go ahead.
I decided to do it, and once I did, I started to dig into why he very likely committed suicide, and it was, of course, that he had had 80 electro conversions on his brain, which had killed his short-term memory. And he was on his way back from one of those when he decided to do himself in. Hmm. And they had been singing old songs from the Paris days in the bar in Idaho, where he hung out with this guy that he liked, the bartender, and his wife, Mary. And they were happy. And the next day, next night, he got up out of bed, went downstairs to the basement where Mary had hid the key in the place that he always knew that she would hide the key, opened the gun cabinet, took out his favorite shotgun, walked across the foyer, walked across the living room, shut the foyer door behind him, kneeled down and shot himself. And I read this and I realized that the man had suffered, he was suffering from dementia. That in 1961, dementia was hardly known about, I think, except by certain doctors researching. Alzheimer's, I don't think, was on the horizon then. Maybe it was, but in a smaller way. And I know that this is a kind of a unproven thing on my part, but I assumed that the man was in dementia and had no other choice that he could see ahead of him. And also the fact that he had lived this incredible life of ripping the skin from his body in order to experience the stuff that he experienced it and simply report it to us, which was his deal. And so I decided to do the play, to write it. And it took me a very short time to write the thing. And it's 90 minutes, but it's really 2 minutes of the last moment of his life. And through that 90 minutes, everything's in his head. All the people he knew, all the things bad things he did, the good things he did. And it takes 90 minutes to work through those things before he actually does it. And the motor for that is a very important thing in a one-man show. Why are you talking to these people? Why are you telling an audience something about yourself that we would never do? So this guy is not talking to his audience. He's talking to his own audience. He's himself. And at the very end, he recalls a poem that his father wrote to him after he published his first book. And my play is based on the letters of Hemingway, not the fiction. There's no fiction in it. It's all his own words. And he reaches out to his dad before he shoots himself. And it's a very, very touching moment to anyone who, like me, has had a dad who I couldn't reach out to. My dad was in Chicago at my sister's house in a fetal position on the bed. And he was still asking for his arf and arf, half bourbon, half water, but he was dying of lung cancer. Of course, my mother gave it to him and grumbled about it and all that, gave him. And she was mad at him because he had refused treatment. But he was a goner anyway. And he rolled over in bed and he looked at me and he said, "Is your insurance paid?" Now I know he was saying, I love you, Larry.
Get it?
Yeah.
That's what I mean. There's so much more in these stories that you write them. And what you just told reminded me of another lesson I took out of the book from the acting world, which, by the way, if I get you to Chicago, I'll show you my Hemingway signed book as well.
Okay.
But I got that too. But you said, you wrote, acting is pretending you're just a conduit for a role. And the better you do it, the more anonymous you should become. That sounds like your Hemingway portrayal.
That's correct. That is correct. I couldn't contact the audience at all. And Lucy was an incredible coach. She watched this whole really sad, harrowing show many times. And she would say to me, no, you're looking at me. You're talking to me now. And of course, that's an actor's thing. You're talking to the audience. No matter how, whether you're looking through the fourth wall or not. But I would have to then go back into the self that was so tortured. Yeah. It was very, very difficult.
See, your life gives us these, as I said, I'm taking all these lessons out of it. I've got a couple of more I want you just to react to. I guess it wasn't the purpose of the book, but it works for me. One is, you write, it's critical that you love yourself, then you can love others. But look out, I'm paraphrasing, but look out because ego can take over.
That's right.
How powerful.
You fight your ego from the day you're born. And when you're my age of almost 90, you think, ego is certainly quelled and had all the dessert it can eat. And then it still bites you on the ankles and says, I want more. So
you also wrote, oh, go ahead.
No, that's all I have to say about ego.
This is one that, I mean, if I was going to put a plaque and put Lawrence Luckenbill under it, it would be a quote from you. But I need you to tell me a little bit about how this impacts your life. And the lesson I took from you was, art is long, but life is short.
Yes, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. Ars longus vita brevis. That's Latin.
And talk about what that means. I get the life is short part. Art is long. Does that mean that our work will outlive us? Our work will outlast us?
It just means that you should not give up. It means do not quit. No matter how long it takes, look who has written one or two books that are just forever. And I'm sure that it took them 10 or 12 or 15 years to write, but they had to get it out. And I feel the same way about my book. And I don't, as you may have noted, I don't blame anyone in my book. I'm not a disser. I don't diss people. I take on all of the problems of my life were caused by me. And that's okay with me. I've finally learned at this later age to forgive that kid. And that kid has forgiven me.
How you remembered the detail in this book, and I know it's why it took you 10 years, because literally the conversations, the details, that's being an actor, I guess. You just remembered everything that surrounded you and present it as such a powerful play. I hope I've now convinced you, maybe Lucy will push you as well, that there is this third book here. There are life lessons that are all spread out throughout this book. It's part of telling your story, but I took them out separately as messages for me. Maybe I'm selfish. I just wanted to take messages for my life.
No. Paul, you are somebody saying something new to me and something really good. And the actual truth is I've looked forward to this conversation because I have melded with you somehow. And I think of you as a friend.
Yes.
And I hope...
Do I owe you money? Wait a minute. No, I'm kidding. Huh? Do I owe you money? No.
Okay. I would like to continue this conversation over time and maybe not on the air, but however. But you're a very interesting man, and I'm interested in your journey too, and your parents. You know, this whole thing is, as I said to you, is very alive to me, this whole business of immigration and changing. My family came from Switzerland. The name is Swiss, Luganbühl, and that's a whole story. And it was, I found out when I went to Switzerland to find out what whether it was true or not that Luganville is Luckenville. I found out that I had a living, that was a living member of the family who was a highly regarded and also highly despised artist in Zurich and in Bern, not Zurich. And his name was Luganville, and I went to visit him. And that's a great story in the book I wrote. Yeah. But what I learned is somewhere in the Luckenville thing is this desire for a better world. Because this guy, this sculptor, said things to me that really opened my eyes to that too. Again and again, people have said things to me that forced me into this idea of social justice and how we must take care of each other.
Final question for you. And by the way, like Mike Nussbaum, I'm sure you will work for the next 10 years. But if somebody came to you and said, Larry, we want you to do one more one-man play, who do you want to portray?
Excuse me. Who was the Israeli prime minister who
Menachem Begin. I was thinking Menachem Begin. Okay.
Was somebody with a real tragic vector in his life. I would try him.
I thought you were going to say David Ben-Gurion, actually, is where I thought you might have been going initially.
Well, that Ben-Gurion comes off as a hero. Menachem Begin comes off as a villain, but he's a tragic villain. Huh. And he represents an area of being Jewish that is, I think, on the side of getting back for the Holocaust. And although that's certainly a way to treat the Holocaust, the other way to treat the Holocaust is to try to understand from both sides what was going on and to try to tikkun olam, repair the world because of that. And at the moment, we see this intractable misery that's being put upon unwary people who don't even know the name Hamas, and they're 3 years old, and they're dying. So there's a whole lot to talk about there.
There is, and what I want my viewers and listeners to know is, first of all, let's tell you where you can get the book: Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com.
Thank you. I forgot all that stuff.
DunburyPress.com. But here's the thing:
audiobook is done.
Yeah. Oh yes. You just did the audiobook, so we'll be waiting
out there. Don't.
Start. Yeah.
Wait. Can you say when? Well, do we know when the audiobook will be released?
July.
No. Okay. All right. So we will see that then. The book is Effective Memories, How Chance and the Theater Saved My Life. I think your phrase about how chance was a tribute to your mother, because I know she always said you just needed to have a chance. And when I saw it in the title, I went, you're not tipping your hat there to mom.
I am.
The other thing that's important for people to understand is it sounds like, oh, did these guys get off track with this? No, we didn't. That's the thing. Yes, this is your life story, but everything we've talked about comes from that book, either in story or in message. And for that, my new friend, Larry Luckenville, I congratulate you. And I sure hope we get to shake hands and drink a little schnapps. I don't like schnapps, but have some gefilte fish. We'll have gefilte fish together in public. Yeah. And I thank you and God bless.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you so much.